try this agenda with our flux schedule. So what I'd like to do tonight is to explain some of the basics of the prenup, some of the issues with that, and the responses to the issues with that, at least in a broad sense. If we don't get to all the details, at least we'll get the broad picture of it. And then probably tomorrow, talk about the get law and about the issues with that, which was a major, major debate. And then after that, I guess by Monday, maybe talk about issues with gittin that are withheld for conditions and how we view things like that. So I think that's the immediate agenda. And I wanted to finish with you, I guess we'll get a chance to do that, that tshuva we were reading for Moshe two nights ago. I realized I didn't bring it with me today. Probably could get it up on the computer, but it'll take a few minutes. Maybe we'll come back to that. But, sorry?
Can I get it on my computer?
Well, if you get it very easily, I think it's Kufla Medala, the Evan Ezer. Kufla Medzayin, even better. Yes, you're right, Kufla Medzayin. Evan Ezer, Kufla Medzayin. So, but basically, either way, let's try to get a general overview of the prenup issue. So, basically, there are many suggestions and many attempts at legislation or other kinds of arrangements that would influence a man to give a get when he is otherwise disinclined from doing so. The major issue that we have, as we've discussed, is that a get cannot be coerced. So we're afraid in general of invoking the law of the land, the secular authorities, in the production of a get. That's basically the biggest issue in the room that the poskim are concerned about. And even though we've been talking until now about situations where coercion is acceptable for get, where we do have kfiyah by a get, so there are two major conditions. That one, the get has to be subject to kfiyah, it has to be circumstances that justify kfiyah. We spent some time discussing what circumstances may or may not qualify. And we noted that there are certain halachic positions that one could take that would make many more circumstances eligible for kfiyah, but they are disputed. So to get a clear psak for kfiyah is sometimes challenging. So we first have to establish that kfiyah is indeed appropriate. And then the kfiyah has to be at least instructed through a bezdin, through the Jewish authorities, that even if it is theoretically a justifiable circumstance, but that decision was made by the non-Jewish authorities, so then that becomes a problem also. If the non-Jewish authorities are acting on the instruction of bezdin, which is not as funny as it sounds, as we'll discuss, it's possible you could have such a circumstance, but then that's a different story, that if you're utilizing the enforcement powers of the civil authorities who are basically saying, we command you to do that which the rabbinic authorities have told you to do, so then there's more to talk about. And that's going to play a big role here. So
you usually can't do that?
So that you can do. If you have a bezdin that has a psak, and the bezdin has the ability to utilize the civil authorities to enforce their psak, then that's workable. Question is, how do you get that to happen? You know, most batidin don't have civil authorities at their beck and call. So how could you make such a thing happen? So one way to do it...
Why is the problem using secular authorities in general?
So if you don't have a bezdin issuing the psak and the assessment is made by the non-Jewish authorities, that's not considered to be a valid method of kfiyah. That's
essentially happens to be right.
Right, even if it coincidentally is right for other reasons, but it's not happening at the instruction of a bezdin, then you have bigger problems. So that's the concern that we have with legislation, and also even with agreements, theoretically, that if, let's say, one were to agree, if one were to say that I'll sign a paper that I'll give a get under a circumstance X, first of all, you're going to have to figure out what circumstance X is. Right? That itself is not as obvious as it seems, not impossible, but not as obvious as it seems. But that gets into serious issues both legally and halachically. Because legally, and this is actually something that you find both in civil law and in halacha, that a kinyan, let's say, in order to obligate yourself in an action, especially without what we call consideration, if there's no payment for it, so to speak, so it's hard to make that binding. Right? So if somebody's just going to make a kinyan and say, I will do something for you, and he's not getting paid for this, it's not something he otherwise is clearly obligated to do. So both from a civil law perspective and a halachic perspective, it's not clear that that is actually a binding commitment. And therefore, it's also not clear that that's not called musa. Now, it's funny that you might say, well, this person took it upon himself. Isn't that by definition willing? So apparently not. And Poskim, including Poskim, who are very supportive of the prenup and other such methods, have at the same time pointed out that ones al yedei atzmo is also ones. So essentially that if you commit yourself in advance to do something, and now you don't want to do it, but you're doing it just because you committed yourself 5 years ago, so then that also could be viewed, we see from the Shulchan Aruch, that could be viewed as ones also. So that's an issue with legislation. And then we see then it's an issue even with agreements, that even if you don't have necessarily legislation involved, but you have the two parties signing an agreement, you still could run into issues. So how do we address this? So the prenups that we recommend are really made up of two elements. So the monetary element we'll mention second, both because that's the most, it's the more controversial part, and also because there's a lot to understand about the other component that's worth talking about first. So, and this is not something that you necessarily notice when you hear about the prenup, so it's worth emphasizing just how valuable this is, and why at least this part, this should be adopted really by everybody, no matter what your attitude is towards the other half of the prenup. And that is that you essentially commit yourself to having your disputes resolved in Beis Din X. Now that Beis Din can be whatever Beis Din you want, but let's say the default position in the RCA prenup is, you know, the Beis Din of America. If you don't like the Beis Din of America, it could be a different Beis Din. But the idea that you settle in advance on a certain venue, so I can tell you just from experience that that alone would probably eliminate a huge, huge percentage of all of the gittin fights, if not 100% of them. That, yes, you know, in the more extreme case, you know, somebody who just flat out wants to refuse for the sake of spite, so it helps for that reason also, because that individual has committed himself to following the ruling of the Beis Din, right? And it's safe to assume that in such a circumstance the Beis Din will say, yes, you are obligated to divorce your wife, and then if the court follows that up and enforces that, so that will be what we discussed before about the psak of Beis Din enforced by the civil authorities. So it should certainly help for those more extreme cases.
Why in this case, just because you commit to a Beis Din, do you get civil authority?
Because if you have a contractual agreement between the two parties that all our disputes will be resolved by binding arbitration in this venue, so that, as far as I understand it, has mostly been upheld by the courts.
Right. So the Jewish court said you have to divorce your wife.
Right. And then... Right, so then whatever, and then if the government is going to enforce that, so then that should be legitimate. So an agreement like that, that much, has been endorsed by Rav Moshe Feinstein in another tshuva, which maybe we'll discuss at more length in the future. And Rabbi Bleich has an article about this, his extensive writings about this in a sefer, B'Nesivas HaHalacha, and he wrote about this also in Journal of Halach Contemporary Society and other places, that basic agreement to arbitrate. So that already has very, very significant impact on the nature of all such disputes. And as I'm starting to explain, that so it's one thing that, okay, somebody just wants to refuse. So bringing him into Beis Din, clearly that's a big accomplishment. But most of the cases that you see, it's not so much that it's, you know, this mustache-twirling villain who says, I just want to cause as much pain as possible that happens. But that's very often not the case. And very often what happens is that there is a dispute about venue, that they each feel that there has to be a settlement on the divorce. It's going to be other issues in terms of child custody, in terms of property, and the like. And the wife feels that either Beis Din X or maybe even secular courts will be more beneficial for her. And the husband feels that Beis Din Y or maybe secular court for him might be, which is less likely the case, but whatever it is, he feels that this venue will be more beneficial to him. And each one says, listen, I'm ready to end this tomorrow. Come to my Beis Din and this will be over. And each side says, listen, I'm the tzaddik here. The other one is the one who is resisting. And this happens all the time. The husband says, listen, I'm going to give her a get the second she comes to Beis Din, and that'll take care of it. And the wife says, I don't trust that Beis Din. I, you know, whatever it is. Or the wife has already gone to secular court, which generally is a prohibition, but sometimes there are circumstances that can justify that, and sometimes there aren't, but it doesn't, you know, then it could still deteriorate into an endless battle over that. So,
what's the prohibition if she goes?
Well, in general, there's a prohibition to have disputes between Jews handled in secular court. Nowadays, that still is the case, and we still ideally recommend Beis Din for all our disputes, including for divorces. But there are circumstances that are exceptions. You know, there are times where a heter or kos can be obtained, either because the other party is not willing to go to Beis Din, or because, let's say, there are elements that Beis Din is not equipped to handle, such as, let's say, criminal activity, something like that. Or it may not have been mutter, but still, and it can't go on forever. So what also conceivably could happen is you could have a couple that wasn't really that religious to begin with, so they never heard of Beis Din before, right? But then the wife goes to secular court because she never heard of anything else, and then the husband somehow finds out that he could maybe get a better deal if he goes to Beis Din. So he says, oh, you know, I'll for sure end this as soon as she comes to Beis Din. And let's say it's already been litigated in secular court, which Beis Din theoretically does not address a case that's already been, you know, if you are happy to take your case to secular court and then after you lose there you decide you want to go to Beis Din. So normally the rule is that we say Beis Din ain't this kokin, that the Beis Din is not supposed to deal with such a person, because the assumption is the person didn't honestly want to take his dispute to Beis Din, but just thought, okay, I lost here, maybe I'll win there. So that's not the type of circumstance Beis Din is supposed to engage. And that would be true if the case was over. That could be true also if the case is progressing, but they decide, okay, it looks like I'm losing here, so now I want to go to Beis Din. So there are circumstances where, whether or not it was beheter, then it could still not be a easy Beis Din fit. And there are all kinds of circumstances that you see all the time, where just for whatever reason, no Beis Din is able to address the situation.
The Jewish Beis Din usually resolves disputes over alimony and child custody?
Theoretically, they should, yeah.
And are those bound by U.S. law? Okay.
For the most part, yes, but not always. Child custody especially. Courts certainly maintain reserve.
They have the knowledge and the credentials, like,
hopefully,
sort of,
yes.
Lawyers too, I guess.
Hopefully, yeah. Beis Din of America. The Beis Din of America has a psychologist as part of the Beis Din, and has, certainly has lawyers as part of the Beis Din. But yeah, they are supposed to be. You know, the details of these issues are described in Shulchan Aruch. They are points of halacha. When it comes to child custody, especially, so the courts reserve their right to override any such decision, and they're more likely to get involved with that. But at least as a starting point, yeah, theoretically, that's the basic assumption.
How do the secular courts look at Jewish bases? Like, how do they?
Well, we have a concept of a binding arbitration. So if you have a body that's recognized as a arbitrator, so then the parties can sign an arbitration agreement, and then that's supposed to be binding. Unless, after the case, then the ruling of a Beis Din can be taken to court for challenge or for approval, and then the court has to figure out, is the ruling completely irrational or against public policy, or do they suspect that there was corruption? There are sometimes circumstances where the court will override it, but theoretically, they're going to uphold the binding arbitration. So, again, you know, there are all kinds of details and exceptions. But basically, what could happen is, so let's say you have a scenario like this, where the couple wasn't even religious to begin with, and then the wife went to court. That's the only thing she ever heard of. And then later on, the husband says, wait, I'll do better if I go to Beis Din. And then he says, finds a Beis Din that may or may not be the most honest Beis Din in the world, and says, oh, listen, I'm a tzaddik, I'm so religious, I just want to follow the halacha, and I'll give her a get as soon as she comes, and why is she portraying me as a terrible person? So, you know, whatever, and I'm giving it a kind of extreme picture here, but it's not to say that you don't have cases where there are, you know, two sides, and there are differences of opinion, and then there could really be, you know, just to go to the other extreme for a second, so you could have a real honest belief on both sides that certain Beis Din is the appropriate way to handle this, and all I want to do is to do things right and just come to Beis Din tomorrow and this will all be over. But each side feels that whichever address they have, let's see again, to give the other extreme, let's say they both in full honesty and good faith think that this is the appropriate way to resolve it, but each one has a different Beis Din that they feel is going to be the honest and fair approach, so then that goes on forever. And that's what happens. It goes on for years and years and years because you reach a stalemate. And each side says, okay, you know, if you just come here, then it'll all be over. And as soon as he, she realizes to do that, then that's all it takes.
Easton would sometimes send them to court?
So not necessarily in those circumstances. There are circumstances where there just is no Beis Din that can deal with it because there's no way to come to agreement. There are other types of circumstances that we can send to court, but you can be sent to court before that. But however you get to that point, so the fight over a venue could be the reason for the endless situation of Igun. Right? That basically a situation could go on for years or indefinitely because each side has a belief that the other side just has to recognize the basic truth of what they're maintaining, and then it'll all be over. So essentially, that's perhaps the most important function of the prenup. And this is the part that is agreed upon more broadly. So even if you don't agree with, we recommend the next part also, but even if you don't agree with the next part, so then at least this much is, it would solve tremendous problems.
Does it have its own special name? Is it also known as a prenup?
Yeah, they're all called prenups. You know, just so you can call it agreement to arbitrate, or, you know, the different versions of it. But essentially, that itself makes a major, major difference. I mentioned that we'll talk about the get law in more detail tomorrow, which, God willing, we will. But just to mention this part first, so we alluded to already that the get law itself, in the current New York State get law, is highly controversial and causes so many problems that there are poskim who say that it clouds every get given in New York State because it creates the threat of mu'usa on every get. So it creates the threat of coercion. It makes it look like every get that's given in New York State, it's a pretty extreme way to formulate it, and everyone would agree with that, but there are poskim who feel that every get that's given in New York State is called under suspicion because of the New York State get law, which clearly is not a good situation. So, as Rabbi Willig points out, that also, if for nothing else, is a reason to sign a prenup. That that prenup solves that problem also. Because, and as he puts it, you know, so people think, oh, the prenup is a new thing, it must be some kind of a kula. He says, don't look at it as a kula, look at it as a chumrah, that if you're worried about the halachic issues that are created by either the New York State get law or by other instruments of civil intervention, so this solves it. So you have said that you will now arbitrate in Beis Din, and you're taking it out of the civil courts. So that itself will address that issue too. So for that reason alone, it's a worthwhile chumrah. And that's enough reason to advocate its widespread adoption. So as Orah points out in their campaigns for the prenup, so they said that even if you have whatever halachic objections to what we'll talk about next, but still doesn't mean that you should not have any kind of prenup. You should have at least a basic prenup that Reb Moshe endorsed and Reb Leich endorsed, that the idea that you have an agreement to arbitrate, you know, very possibly that alone, I think, may solve even 100% of the problems. It'll have a tremendous, tremendous impact on the problems. And we'll solve other problems also, perhaps also address the issues created by the get law. And again, that we'll get into more detail tomorrow, God willing. But so what's the other part of the prenup? So the other part of the prenup is the monetary part. And that's where there's a little bit more controversy, and we'll discuss how to possibly address the controversy. So there basically are, let's say, two concerns with the monetary part, or with any monetary agreement. So one concern is that you risk the threat of ones al yedei mamon that we started to discuss last time. Right? That maybe the person who is giving the get is doing so not of his own free will, but because of monetary pressure that is exerted upon him. The second is a concern which is both related and separate at the same time. And that is a concern called asmachta. Familiar with the concept of asmachta? So this is another segue that gets us into next year, into Sanhedrin, that when you learn Sanhedrin, so you learn about asmachta, because when you learn about psulei edus, so one of the types of categories of people who are excluded from edus are gamblers. And one of the issues with gambling is a problem called asmachta. That basically, asmachta means that a person makes a commitment, and the commitment is considered to be not really genuine. It's basically a contingency commitment. You say that if X happens, I'll do Y, or I'll pay Y, I'll pay you money if X happens. And the concern is, it's the type of contingency that you don't think it's ever going to happen. So, therefore, you made this commitment not really actually planning on going through with it. And when you're asked to pay, it's basically against your will. And the money is basically being extracted from you against your will. Right? So, to give an extreme example, if somebody says, all right, you hired me to do this job, and you need it done by Thursday, and I say, yeah, I'm very confident I can do it by Thursday. Telling you, if I don't do it by Thursday, I'll give you $1 million. Right? So what do you mean when you say something like that? You mean that you're completely sure you're going to do it. So you don't actually have intent to pay $1 million. You are so sure that you'll get it done that you're expressing that this is what you'll do if you don't get it done. Now, this is a matter of judgment to a certain extent, because there are reasonable costs a person could take. Like, let's say a person might theoretically make a deal saying, listen, you know, you need this job done by Thursday. And I understand that. But so I recognize that if it's done by Thursday, you'll pay me this much, and that if I don't get it done by Thursday, you'll pay me less. You know, so theoretically, that could be reasonable, and that could be a legitimate type of arrangement. So it's a little bit of a judgment call when it falls into one category, when it falls into another category. But theoretically, out there is something called asmachta, where the number doesn't really correlate to an actual commitment you really want to make. So that connects to gambling, because the assumption is that when two people make a bet, so why is this person making a bet? He's making a bet because he thinks he's going to win. And when he loses, so the other guy makes him pay. The concern is that the winner is taking money that is not really owed to him, and that it's a type of theft. It's not actual theft, but it's close enough to theft that we disqualify this person from testimony. Because the idea basically is that why is the loser paying the winner the money? So he doesn't owe him the money in any real sense. He didn't buy anything from him. He didn't damage his property. He didn't borrow money from him beforehand. He doesn't have any legitimate debt to this person. The only thing that's obligating him is because he said, if I lose the game, I'll pay you the money. So how real is that obligation? So our concern is it wasn't real at all. He said that because he thought he was going to win. Well, he's not looking to give away money for nothing. He said that because he thought he was going to win. So now when the winner takes it, he's taking money that doesn't have any legitimate basis to be taken, and it's essentially against the will of the loser. So basically that is somewhere in the family of theft. So we are concerned about issues like that in general. So some raise the concern like this also, that if you're going to say that I'll give you a certain amount of money under this circumstance, maybe that concern is asmachta. Maybe there isn't really a full commitment when the person signs this. And that has two types of problems. One problem is that maybe it's a type of gezel, essentially, that maybe the person taking this money is basically stealing it. And then the compounded concern, I guess, which will make it more serious, is that, therefore, also, that will invalidate the get. That because the monetary issue is illegitimate, then that creates a monetary pressure that's not based in a real chov, and therefore that's going to call the get into question. So with those objections in mind, so what exactly is the method of the prenup that we endorse that hopefully addresses these issues? So first and foremost, it's not about a penalty. It's not about saying that the husband has to pay a penalty if he doesn't give a get, because that would perhaps raise a specter of onus al yedei mamon. Again, we mentioned last time that onus al yedei mamon is itself a little bit of a question, that many assume that onus al yedei mamon is a problem, and l'chadchila we worry about that. Whether all the Rishonim really agree to that, whether it's a problem b'di'eved, we could talk about that in more length, but at least l'chadchila, and maybe b'di'eved, we assume that onus al yedei mamon is something to worry about. So if this was phrased as a penalty, okay, that would scare us a little bit. Or a lot bit, depending on how you understand the issue. But the point is that it's not phrased as a penalty. Basically, it's phrased as mizonos. That the husband obligates himself, in general, to support his wife. So what the prenup formalizes is that if they're all living together and everything is lovey-dovey and shalom al Yisrael, so then they're living in the same house and they're eating the same food and paying for everything with the same credit card and whatever her needs are taken care of. But if they're not living in the same house, so then he can't just take care of her needs by providing all these same things that a happily married couple has to share. So he has to give her cash in order to accomplish that. So we translate that obligation into a relatively high, but not ridiculously high, number per day, which I believe at the moment it's at about $150 a day, the assumption that that's what the wife will need to live on during this time. Again, the number has to be carefully selected, because if it's too low, it's not going to be effective. And if it's too high, then it's not going to correlate to anything real, and then you're going to trigger all other kinds of issues, both legally and halachically and everything else. So essentially, it has to realistically correlate to a level of support that the husband is paying for the wife. So that again, the emphasis that it's not a penalty, the emphasis that essentially it's the reality of being married. So if the husband gives his wife a get now, he's not giving a get to get out of the penalty. He's giving the get to stop being married, which is what the get is supposed to be. And the reason any person gives a get is because he's not happy about being married. So, okay, he's not happy that being married makes him pay an extra $150 a day. So he'll want to end that marriage by giving the get. So some might ask, some do ask, worth asking.
Yeah, he would have to pay the $150 if he didn't give her the get yet, right?
Right.
So maybe he'll hold on to the get because he might not want to pay the more alimony money, I guess, maybe. And just keep paying $150 a day.
No. Oh, I mean, he'll eventually have to pay. You know, he's not going to have to be obligated to more alimony than that.
No, he'll rather just pay the $150 every day, which will be cheaper than maybe the...
No, it probably won't be.
No?
Yeah, no, yeah, because I'm ultimately going to have to pay both. But, yeah, $150 a day is pretty high. It's basically full-time support. Now, what there is a concern is the other way around. And that's there's methods to deal with. That some have raised the objection that the wife might prefer being married than divorced for that reason. Right? That she gets a better deal with a prenup than with alimony. And either she may pull some shtick and move out but not actually initiate a divorce, which newer versions of the prenup are being revised a little bit to address that. We'll talk about that. Or there was a story in today's Jerusalem Post, I think, that she may refuse to accept again. Now, that again, there's also ways to address that. But we mentioned at the outset that that also could happen, that the wife could refuse to accept the get and cause problems for the husband. And there are some who are concerned that maybe this will motivate that. So, again, the prenup has, especially now in the newer versions, has clauses to address that, but theoretically, that's more of a concern, that the wife will want to stay with this circumstance, want to stay married, because she's benefiting from this arrangement more than not being married. So, essentially, one might ask that, you know, we already have a prenup. Now, it happens to be true, by the way, that prenups such as this do have their roots in earlier Sfarim, the Nesivis and the Torah Zegitin. It was brought in the Sefer Nachla Shiva. That there are earlier agreements that essentially work along these lines. But one might say we have an earlier agreement like this also. We spent all year learning about it, right? What's it called? Ksuba, right? The Ksuba already obligates the husband to support his wife. So who needs the prenup? Right? Let's just have the Ksuba. And he already undertook that he's going to support her. So why isn't that enough? So that, as Rabbi Willig emphasizes, that's a dangerous approach. Because there are many possible loopholes that one could find. Again, if you spent all year learning Ksubas, so you could see where various machlokasin will come up. Just to mention two, what if, so in general, in terms of the terms of the Ksuba, so is the husband obligated to support his wife if she's not living with him? So it probably depends on whose fault it is. That if he made life miserable for her and she had to move out, but it's all because he's being terrible, so then he's obligated to still support her. But if she just decided she wants to live in the Bahamas while he lives in Washington Heights, and she wants him to keep supporting her there, so then he's not obligated to support her. Now, the problem is it's going to be his word against hers, right? So even if the circumstances are that he really is obligated, it's going to be up to her to prove that it's his fault. And as we know, motzi mechaver l'faraya, the burden of proof is always on the one who wants to get paid. And the benefit is always, the advantage is always to the one who would do the paying. So it's very easy to imagine a circumstance where the husband will be able to claim that he doesn't have an obligation of mizonos, and the wife will not be so easily able to refute that. Another question that could come up in a more complex discussion is, what if she's making money on her own? So theoretically, she might have to pay that money to the husband in exchange for her mizonos. Now, there's a very good halachic case to be made that she does not owe him this money for many different reasons, which we won't get into right now for the interest of time. But again, you want to leave it to that, that she'll have to prove it in Besdin that he owes her the money. All kinds of questions could be brought up. So it's those are two examples of where a question could be raised, whether or not he's really chayiv in the mizonos. So therefore, the prenup just formalizes that. It basically says that the chiyuv mizonos that exists already, here are the terms that I'm agreeing to, very specific terms, that if the wife is not living in the home, then the husband will pay mizonos at this rate, regardless of whose fault it is or whose fault we think it is. Either way, that's the story, and that saves all these loopholes, basically plugs up all these loopholes. And again, theoretically, there could be ways that the wife could exploit loopholes of her own, so then newer versions and other methodologies have been suggested to address that, first of all, that it should only kick in at a certain point. The wife, let's say, should have to announce that she's officially beginning divorce proceedings and she officially wants to start collecting. Because theoretically, you could have a circumstance, let's say, where there's a trial separation. And so she moves out, and then they get back together again later. And then later on, it still doesn't work, and so there is a divorce. And then the wife says, okay, I want to go back from when the trial separation started, that terms the prenup.
That's what happened in the case.
In the case in the paper today.
I think that was
yeah. So that, you know, again, the prenup has also been revised to address that circumstance. Or again, let's say a circumstance where the wife says, I'm not going to accept the get. So that's also put into the prenup, that, you know, the certain circumstances like that, which terminate the obligation. But basically the goal is to plug up the loopholes on both sides so that this can replace the chiyuv mizonos in a clear, defined terms, and therefore there's an obligation to keep that up. So I think we'll have to maybe segue until we'll have to leave a little bit over for tomorrow, and we'll continue then. But basically just the understanding is, as far as asmachta, so that this should not be asmachta for several reasons. That various posts can bring up. Now, there are those who think it is a smachta, and that's why you see some opposition to it. But those who have endorsed the prenup, which includes distinguished figures such as Marina Rebbeinu, Herschel Shechter Shlita, Marina Rebbeinu, Mordechai Willig Shlita, Rabbi Willig, as you know, is the author of the prenup, together with Hagoyim Ibzam Nechemiah Goldberg Shlita. So these are very broad shoulders. Ibzam Nechemiah actually had written an article where he proposed the basic format, and this is about 1988 or so, and Rabbi Willig read the article and said, you know, why don't we make a document that formalizes this? And he went to great efforts to meet with Ibzam Nechemiah in Eretz Yisrael and to get Rav Chaim Symbolist to sign on to it, who was also a very prominent dayan in Eretz Yisrael, and Rav Libus, who was a dayan in New York before that, and others to sign on to this. And it's a tremendous thing that we have now. So the position of the poskim as far as asmachta is a couple of, just to mention very quickly, it's about out of time, but a couple of ways to address it. One way is, first of all, to say me'achshav, that you're not saying, I will do this later, but that basically I accept this now under those circumstances. There is also an idea that a deal that's made in a Bezdin Chashuv can override Hasmachta, and that the assumption is that the husband can commit himself as if this was a Bezdin Chashuv, if that is not actually the case. Maybe it's at least Kiyulu the case. Also, the idea that Hasmachta, as Rav Shechter emphasizes, asmachta should only apply if we're dealing with something exaggerated. And if this isn't exaggerated, so then it shouldn't be asmachta. It's also pointed out, as Amnon Chemi pointed out, that even in Timsi Lomar, that it is asmachta, which we hope it isn't, because we don't want to be stealing from anybody, but even worst-case scenario, that it is asmachta, so it still doesn't invalidate the get, because the get is not explicitly connected to this payment. Right? We don't say, give the get or else you have to make this payment. The payment is connected with staying married. And the get is there to end the circumstance of marriage and therefore to end the payment. So his feeling was that even worst case scenario, if it was considered to be asmachta, it wouldn't possible the get. There are other factors also that should help, that because it's not an exaggerated amount, so in the whole question of onus l'ayidei mamon, and this was alluded to by the tshuva we saw from Moshe yesterday, that I guess we'll have to finish this tomorrow, but that even if you say that onus mamon is onus, which again is a position that we're at least worried about, but there are questions of degree, and that it could be that lower level penalties don't rise to the level of onus, and therefore if this is a number which is correlated enough to the normal obligations of marriage, so then even in Timsi Lomar that it could be constituted as a penalty, but it's not a penalty that's really extracting too much out of the wallet. So therefore that's perhaps not going to be considered onus mamon anyway. Okay, so a few more points to say about that, but we're a little bit out of time. So tomorrow, God willing, we'll meet at the normal time at 7 o'clock, if everything else is equal, hopefully. So then we'll say a few more words about this, and then maybe try to explain also the debate about the get law and see how they connect to each other. All right, I wish you all a wonderful night.